Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. As a child growing up in communist Hungary, Kati Martin was keenly aware of how different her life was from her Budapest playmates. The daughter of two journalists employed by Western news agencies, Kati and her sister lived in a rarefied community of English-speaking diplomats who were despised by the Hungarian communists. In a new memoir titled Enemies of the People, Kati Martin delves into Hungarian secret police files to find out what her parents' lives were really like behind the Iron Curtain and how they were able to forge a new life of freedom in America. Kati Martin joins me in the studio to describe what it was like to discover her family's deepest secrets. Welcome to the studio, Kati.
Thanks, Kati. I'm delighted to be back here. It's my favourite stop on the book tour.
And we will be opening the phones in just a moment. 1-800-433-8850 is, of course, the phone number, and you can send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. Kati, 20 years ago today, the Berlin Wall came down.
Indeed.
Your family was already living in America, and we're going to go back over the story in Hungary in just a moment.
Right.
But what was your family's response to that wall coming down?
Well, to be honest with you, it was a day that we never thought would happen in our lifetime. I was actually in Budapest when it happened, covering the events with my then husband Peter Jennings for ABC News, and I remember being in a sea of Hungarians, but surrounded also by American journalists, and I was doing the translation for what was going on for all the Americans. And as usual, I was trying to bridge the two cultures. But at that moment, when the wall was coming down, I felt so proud to be Hungarian and so proud that I was there really when the unraveling of the empire began, which really began in Budapest in October 1956, which was the first popular uprising against the Soviet monster. And of course, it was crushed massively by Soviet tanks, and 20,000 people were killed in fighting in the streets of Budapest, among my earliest and most vivid childhood memories were of those exhilarating and then bloody days. But after Budapest 56, the Soviet Empire could never again claim that it was a popular movement, and thus it was the beginning of the end.
Let's go back in time to your childhood in Hungary. How much do you remember of your young years there?
A great deal, because although I was a little kid when my parents were arrested, I was 6 years old when the secret police agents knocked on our apartment door and asked that I get my mother. And I have always marked that day as the end of my childhood, because, as you said, I had a rather privileged childhood. We were living in this kind of unreal place where my parents were the last free journalists reporting from behind the Iron Curtain to the West. Basically, all the news that the free world, as it was then called, got from behind the Iron Curtain was as a result of my mother and father's work for AP and UPI. And it was only a matter of time before they themselves were dragged off, as so many others had, and had a fake trial, which convicted them of being CIA agents and sentenced them to very long prison terms, which they only served a portion of. My father 2 years, my mother 1 year, because of the surge of the pre-revolutionary mood of Budapest in 56, Moscow ordered the release of political prisoners such as my parents to kind of calm the waters. It didn't work, but I got my parents back. Those were the most obviously marking memories of my childhood, the terrible year when I had no parents at all, and none of our Hungarian friends wanted to look after my sister and me because we were radioactive as the kids of Enemies of the People, which, by the way, is not only the title of my book, it's how the files, the secret police files on which Enemies of the People is based, continually refers to them as enemies of the people.
And those files document, before your parents were arrested, those files document something that you already knew, which was this rather kind of extraordinary life that your parents had in this communist country, but you describe them with these dinner parties with American diplomats and playing bridge until two in the morning, this driving that huge white soft-top car around the streets of Budapest. And it must have stuck out like a sore thumb.
Totally. I say we drove a white Studebaker convertible, we would say. Sorry, Caddy, we would not say soft-top, we would say convertible. There are still differences. At a time when there were 2,000 private cars in the whole country, you can only imagine that I say in the book that it was, we might as well have been riding around in a rocket. But there was something reckless in my parents' behavior, particularly. I'm a mother myself, and so I'm a little bit critical of how they behaved, given that they were the parents of small children. But they were determined to act as if it were normal to cover events as a real journalist, as opposed to a flack for the regime. And at a time when most Hungarians would rather cross the street to avoid brushing up against an American, my parents, as you said, were regular visitors to the American embassy.
Your mother was a mean card shark, it sounds like.
Oh, yes. Did not inherit that talent, happy to say. I think because there was too much card talk in the house, I didn't want to do that. But bridge was one of their points of where they met with Western diplomats and journalists.
Kati, do you think to some extent the fact that they had these close ties and they socialized with the American diplomats? You have a photograph in the book of your mother with a group of American diplomatic wives, and of course she is the only Hungarian in the group.
Always.
As you say, always. Mm. Do you think that gave them the illusion of invulnerability?
Absolutely. It was an incredibly naive escapist. But let me just say that I've ceased being judgmental about my parents the deeper I got into the files and realized the full horror of daily life behind the Iron Curtain. You know, we hear usually from the historians, from the macro, the policy level. But this is, I think what Enemies of the People does is really captures the human cost of this regime. And my parents paid a huge price for their kind of delusional behavior. Delusional in that they ended up paying for it in prison. But for a while, they lived as if it was okay to cover events objectively. And since all the news from behind the Iron Curtain from 1948 until 1989 was consistently bad, it was tantamount, reporting it was tantamount to, in the eyes of Moscow, tantamount to betraying the system.
You found out a huge amount about their lives, about their relationship together when you opened those files, and you were warned that this would be like opening Pandora's box. Why did you wait until they died to go to Budapest and sit and look through all of those files?
Well, they died 4 years ago, in my father's case, five in my mother's. And with their death, the taboo on the past was lifted. I think one reason that they did so well, I'm flash forwarding to when we finally reach sanctuary here in the United States, one reason that they made such successful Americans and they did begin life anew here was because they were so forward-looking. They really didn't want to dwell. The past had too many shadows. They barely survived the fascist, the Nazi occupation of Hungary. My grandparents, my maternal grandparents, did not. They were in an Auschwitz transport in 1944. Again, something that I was not told as a child.
You'd been raised a Christian.
Oh, yes.
You didn't know that you were Jewish?
No, no.
Until you started doing research for the book.
I was raised as an extremely pious Roman Catholic, never missed confession on Saturday, Mass on Sunday. And even in Hungary, where it was illegal to go to church, we had nuns instructing us. My parents were assimilated Hungarian Jews who were very patriotic Hungarians, and you know, they fit that stereotype of the of those European Jews for whom the Holocaust came as an absolute obviously unexpected and shattering development, and which they really until the very last minute denied that it could happen to them.
How did they manage to avoid themselves being picked up by the Nazis?
They were hidden. And by the way, this I only learned through the files. They were hidden by Christian friends. They never wore the yellow star. They were
and
always
that in
on
itself,
the
of course, was illegal.
Punishable by death. Yeah. So they were incredibly brave people, but there was an element of how shall I put it, almost of arrogant recklessness on their part. There was an almost flamboyant quality to their descent, and I think having survived the Nazis, they were perhaps filled with a sense of their own invulnerability, and they had a sense that this time the Americans were their patrons, and indeed they were. My parents both worked for the Americans, and that with patrons such as the Associated Press for my father, the United Press International for my mother, they would be invulnerable. That was not the case, as it turned out.
Kati Martin is the author of her new book, is Enemies of the People, My Family's Journey to America. She's a former NPR and ABC News correspondent on the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Do join us for your questions and comments on her book about life behind the Iron Curtain. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wmu.org. Stay listening. Welcome back. I'm Kati Kaye of the BBC. I'm joined in the studio by Kati Martin. She is the author of Enemies of the People, My Family's Journey to America. Kati, before we went to break, we were describing the life that your parents had during the Second World War as Jews living in Hungary and how they managed to escape being picked up by the Nazis. And then this period that they had, this extraordinary period they had before they were arrested. But I want you to take us now to the arrest of your father, because you describe that in the book, that extraordinary scene of them coming back late one night.
Yes, well, it was all carefully timed. My father's abduction took place at 2 a.m. following my parents' weekly game of bridge with the American military attaché. That in itself was meant to be incriminating. And it was an icy, snowy night in Budapest, and my father had just finished parking the car and was coming around to help my mother out of the car. He was carrying a bucket of ashes to sprinkle on the way to, there was a block between the parking place and our house, to sprinkle along the way, when suddenly the night came alive with figures closing in on my parents. And before my father could even give his wife a kiss, a proper goodbye kiss, they grabbed him above the elbows and led him away. And my mother, who kept a journal of these years, which has really helped in my reconstruction, said that Papa, as we called my father, thrust the bucket of ashes at her as though it were their most prized possession, and then she cried, "Aren't you even going to kiss me?" And he just leaned over, but his arms were no longer his own. So he just leaned over and kissed her, and he was led away. And then my mother was followed into our apartment by a handful of agents, and they then proceeded to rip our home apart. And the moment I really mark as the end of my childhood was that night when my mother came into the room I shared with my sister and told us to get up because they needed to search our room. And I have this vision that has never left me all these years later, of my sister and I scurrying toward our parents' bedroom while one of the agents with a knife stabbed my oldest possession, which was my rocking horse, and straw spilling out of that old beast, and. The rest of the night is a fog for me, but I think it was post traumatic shock or whatever, because it was the end of our privileged life.
You didn't know it at the time, but somebody was watching the whole scene.
Yes, by a piece of very good fortune, the house next door to ours was a American diplomatic residence, and still is today. And a diplomat named Don Downs observed the whole scene. He'd been out walking his dog and observed my father's abduction and immediately cabled the State Department in Washington and then went upstairs and was able to observe the search of our apartment and was able to describe that. And thus, Washington was early on brought in to the case of the Martins. And that proved to be extraordinarily fortunate for us because, in fact, thus began a year of – because my mother's arrest, they gave my mother – very generously, they gave my mother 4 months to figure out what to do with my sister and me. And my mother made very careful plans because she knew – can you imagine living with that thought that any day it would be your turn? Honestly, I came to so respect my mother for her conduct. Children take their parents entirely too for granted, and don't, especially mothers and daughters. That's a complicated relationship. I now see my mother as an extraordinarily brave, spunky lady who really with two. Needy and semi-hysterical little girls wondering what happened to their papa. She had to keep us calm. She was reporting then. She assumed not only her responsibilities reporting for her wire service, but my father's. She also took on AP. And then came the day when they came for her, which was another very traumatic memory for me, because there I did open the door.
And she knew all along that she was being watched by Arvo, by the secret police?
You know,
your parents were aware of it?
You know, Caddy, I don't think my parents realized the full extent of the surveillance, which only the files have revealed, that really it was 20 years of total surveillance, because I'm sure we'll get into when we got to Washington, which was also a shocker, that the surveillance continued. The surveillance was such that every piece of every envelope that we received had been steamed open. Every telephone conversation tapped. They were being followed, and worst of all, our inner circle was penetrated by informers and agents.
I wanted to ask you about that because that was, I think, one of the most shocking revelations in a way when you went back to Budapest and opened the files.
Yes.
Just to see how many people that your parents have been close to.
Yes.
Were actually betraying them.
Yes, but you know, again, I stopped along the way being as severe in my judgments because, you know, the old thing about walk a mile in their shoes. the other guy's shoes. Fear is such a powerful weapon and it really was the basis of the Soviet Empire. Fear and intimidation, and getting the population to be complicit in the regime.
And that's even a horrible your babysitter, thing. Even your own babysitter.
Worst of all, we had this French babysitter, and this, I have to say, is kind of belated vindication for me because I never liked her, and it was mutual. She always liked my sister better. And I kept trying to tell my parents, this woman is not an appropriate choice for a babysitter. She's always in a hurry. Well, now we know why. She was a full-time agent, and she was using my sister and me as her primary sources. And she was actually egging on the regime to arrest my parents and giving them prompts about when would be a good time to do that. Can you imagine a babysitter? She did teach me French, so I thank her for that. But she's no longer alive. But I did find others who
And the vast majority of the people at the American Embassy, of course, were very helpful.
Indeed.
They helped you, supported your parents the whole way through their incarceration and then helped them get out again afterwards. But there was one who was not.
No, this was, again, a source of pain for my parents, who were incredibly patriotic Americans, considered America as our last sanctuary. Indeed, it was. But there was a mole in Le Carré language inside the embassy, an assistant military attaché who was himself being blackmailed by the Hungarian secret police, caught in, you've read these spy novels, caught in what is commonly called a honeypot, i.e. in bed with an agent, photographed, blackmailed.
Classic Soviet sting.
Yes, absolutely. Except, unfortunately, this was true. This wasn't made up by...
So he was informing the Hungarian authorities about your parents' activities.
Yes, about their activities inside the American embassy. And where my parents, again, had the delusion of being absolutely secure, particularly in the ambassador's office. And my father did sort of cross the line, a line that reporters don't normally cross, because he felt that in the Cold War there was a right side, and the right side was the West, was America. So he was giving the American ambassador advice and thought he could do so in the privacy of the office, but he couldn't, and this man was informing on him when, for example, my father was very disturbed that the Soviet propaganda machine was cranking out all this stuff about how America's a racist society and that black Americans are ill-treated and second-class citizens. As a matter of fact, in the 50s, they often were, but never mind, bothered my father. So my father advised the ambassador to ask the State Department to send an African-American diplomat to Budapest to counter that propaganda, which they did. America's first African-American owed his post to Budapest to my father. I'm sure he wasn't aware of that. But that provided evidence against my father because the mole, the man who was being blackmailed, told the Hungarians that advice came from my father. But there was something even more serious. My father smuggled a document out of the Hungarian Parliament and loaned it to the American Embassy overnight. And again, this was reported. So ultimately, it wasn't just the work of our circle of informers, who ranged from the babysitter to our dentist. I mean, pretty much everybody. But most people were compelled to do that. I don't know if you saw the wonderful German film The Lives of Others. That pretty much captured this atmosphere of intimidation and how people can decent people, ordinary people, can be compelled into doing indecent things under such a reign. May it never come again.
Kati, there are lots of moments in the book that must have come to you as horrors when you were going through those files and you realized what your parents had gone through. But some of the most upsetting must have been their time in prison, and particularly your father's time.
Yes, that was hard. That was hard. My father never discussed the full nightmare. He did write a prison memoir called The Forbidden Sky about his time in prison, but he doesn't dwell on just how brutalized he was, the interrogation that he underwent day after day, you know, having to stand against a wall while obscenities were shouted at him. And he never mentions the fact that even in his cell, he was under total observation by cellmates who themselves were agents, writing full reports about his daily condition. And that made pretty gruesome reading for his daughter. And that twice he tried to commit suicide. That was hard. You know, I kept thinking, my gosh, he would, you know, he would have missed my childhood, my coming of age, he would never have seen his children as grown-ups. He wouldn't have met my children, his grand. I mean, the whole thing just seems just inconceivable. But he was very systematically collecting sleeping pills, which the prison handed out with great abandon, because the prisoners were already sedated with sedative in the morning coffee. I don't think my parents knew that, but the files reveal that. But in addition to that, my father asked for sleeping pills, which you were supposed to take those in front of the prison warden, but he figured out a very tricky way of, you know, pretending to pop it under his tongue, and then he collected. He had 60. He figured he needed 100 to do the job, and some of it spilled out of his pocket. And the informer cellmate reported it. So in fact, this treacherous, vile cellmate ended up saving my father's life by reporting.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email with your questions or comments for Cathy Martin. Her new book is Enemies of the People, and our email address, of course, is drshow@wmu.org. Let's go to Marcella, who joins the program from Greensboro, North Carolina. Marcella, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm actually very intrigued by your book, and I'm glad you're doing this, because I am from the Czech Republic. I came here in 1969 with my father and brother, and lots of things.
Marcella, I'm going to stop you there. There's a problem with your telephone. If you'd like to call back, we'll take your call again, but we're getting a lot of echo on your line. So if you can call back, that would be great. Let's go to Shirley in Lawrence, New Hampshire. Shirley, you've joined the program.
Hi. Yes, I was, of course, listening quite some time ago when they were talking about how the Jews in Europe, and particularly in Germany and Austria, were totally unaware of what was going to happen. I mean, they had their heads firmly in the sand, in spite of all the signs out there. Actually, in my husband's family, quite a few of the family were lost, but my mother-in-law, God bless her, was a strong-minded woman, and she knew what was going to happen. She knew it like 5 years before it actually did, because she began to get the vibes. And she got her kids out, two boys, out to Switzerland to school, and they were visiting them there in Switzerland when the Germans went into Czechoslovakia. And Peter's father called up to see what, you know, things were there. Was it safe to go back? And of course, you know, somebody with a gun to his head probably was saying, "Oh, it's fine. Come back. Nothing's happening. You're fine. You're fine," etc. And so he was all ready to go.
Yes.
But his wife hid the passports, and he couldn't go.
Yeah.
And the next day the word came in. I mean, it hadn't happened yet when he first called. And wow. she saved the whole family.
Shirley, that's an extraordinary story. Katie, did your parents, before the war, ever think of trying to get out of Hungary?
You know, the Budapest Jewish community was so assimilated and so secular. People like my parents, who formed the middle class of the city, the professional class. My parents each had a PhD. My father was an economist. My mother is a historian. They considered themselves fully integrated into Hungarian society, and they spoke languages. They had both traveled far and wide in Europe, considered themselves to be very international people. But Budapest was their hometown, which they adored. It was a spectacular place, and had been extremely tolerant in their childhood, in their early childhood. And as I say, they both had PhDs. They had no reason and to imagine that
and they didn't have this inkling that Shirley was talking about from her mother-in-law.
No, but that was a different country. The Hungarian Jewish situation was particularly appalling because Hungarian Jews were so assimilated, and it was the last intact Jewish community in Europe. It was not until 1944, when really the war, if you were a sane person, you could see the war was over. The Allies had long since landed in Normandy. They escaped until the spring of 44, which is when the Nazis invaded Hungary. And so really it was a 6-month occupation that was more intense because it had to move fast than any other.
Katie Martin is author of Enemies of the People. Do join our conversation. 1-800-433-8850 is the number.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Working at a Japanese newspaper, Jake Adelstein knew he'd offended a crime boss when he got a phone call.
And the phone call was essentially, you've made the old man very angry. You have 3 hours to show up at this meeting at the Shinjukeo Plaza Hotel. And I said, well, what if I don't show up? And the answer was, well, you'll be dead by the weekend.
On the next Fresh Air, Jake Adelstein, author of Tokyo Vice. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Katie Kay of the BBC. I'm joined in the studio by Katie Martin. She is the author of Enemies of the People, My Family's Journey to America. Katie, before the break, we were talking about your father's time in prison particularly. Tell me a little bit about what happened at his trial, because both he and your mother, of course, were being tried as spies.
Yes. My father was the arch spy, my mother the accessory to the... first of all, it was the first time that they had seen each other in almost a year. So it was a very dramatic meeting of the two of them. For me, the most powerful scene in my own book is when my parents have this prison reunion, because my mother often said that prison saved their marriage, and I never quite understood what she meant by that. But now I do. Among the shocking things the files revealed was that my parents' marriage was pretty much on the brink when they were arrested. Both of them had dalliances outside the marriage. But in prison, they kind of fell in love all over again. And there's the scene of their prison reunion, first in the courtroom where they faced the most bloody-minded judge, a judge who a year later during the revolution committed suicide because he knew the writing was on the wall for people such as himself. During the early stages of the Hungarian Revolution and its most violent eruption, they were lynching secret police agents. I mean, that was not a very pleasant aspect of the otherwise heroic revolution. So this guy committed suicide, but not before he sentenced my parents to, on the first round, 23 years.
And how much did you know about the trial? Did you have any information?
No.
Did the American embassy have any information about what was happening? Was it all behind closed doors?
There was a news blackout for several months afterward. My sister and I had been placed with total strangers who were paid a certain monthly sum to look after us because, as I said, none of my parents' friends wanted to be seen looking after children of enemies of the people. So we were pretty miserable, but nobody talked about our parents. We were living on the outskirts of the city in rather meager circumstances, and going to a school where only the children of the poorest and most unemployed population went. So nobody talked about our parents. In general, people didn't talk about those who were in prison or had been taken away because it was dangerous to do so. At night, we would pray for our parents. And my sister and I made a pact that we would never both cry at the same time, and we pretty much stuck to that. When I tell these stories to my children, who I'm happy to say are safe and sound and very American, they look at me with big eyes like, you know, is it possible, Mom, that you had this kind of a childhood? But the fact is that not only did I have a childhood like this, but millions did. You know, that's the thing that we need to recall as we mark the end of the 20th anniversary of the fall of communism, that, you know, for a half a century, little kids like me lived such lives, and you know, it was considered almost acceptable that a father would not only not see his children for almost 2 years, but have no news of them. And that was really how they broke my parents, was withholding any information about us. Which, can you imagine anything more cruel than that?
And it got to both of your parents. Let's go to Andre, who joins the program from Charlotte, North Carolina. Andre, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
You. Jó reggelt kívánok!
Jó reggelt, André! Shall we continue in Hungarian?
Yes. No. We can continue in English.
Okay.
I'm really impressed with your story.
Thank you.
I immigrated in 1951 with my parents. They fled from Hungary in 1944 into Germany.
Yeah.
So that's where I was born, in a refugee camp. But I remember distinctly when we came here in 1956, and you brought back the memory so vividly. I just want to tell you, sitting with my father, listening to Radio Budapest on the shortwave, and being thrilled,
yes,
at what was happening, and then the devastation,
yes,
following was really unbelievable.
Yes, and it felt so personal, the letdown. I mean, I had never seen that was the first time in my life that I'd seen my parents actually happy. And then it was such a crashing disappointment when it was all over. It felt extremely personal.
And of course, it was in the run up, Kati, to the 56 revolution, yes, that your parents were actually suddenly, almost as suddenly as they were taken from you,
they were released.
Were released.
Yes, yes, without any warning, and so we were a family again. And they,
of course, as a sign of the, and it was a sign of how much things had loosened up. In fact,
well, this was as a result of Khrushchev's 20th Party speech, which began the de-Stalinization process, so we had these few weeks really as a quote normal family, and it was thrilling. And then, of course, they both immediately went back to their old professions, unrepentant, reporting for the Americans. And
your father filed on his release that very evening, didn't he?
Yes.
Came out of prison, sat down at his typewriter, and filed his.
Yes,
story.
I have a picture of that in the book. To me, he looked like quite a different man. My very handsome father, who went into prison without a gray hair on his head, you know, came out looking. I'd never seen such pallor and quite gray. And of course, it didn't occur to me that his real scar was internal, and that having been as brutalized and humbled as he had been in prison, how could he be exactly the same man?
So they reported on the revolution.
Yes, indeed, brilliantly, bravely, again providing the West its knowledge of that historic event. And when the tanks rolled in on November 4th at dawn, that had to have been one of the most shattering memories from my childhood, is when my parents again woke us up and bundled us into the little Volkswagen Beetle that the AP had loaned them. And we knew that if we stayed in our Budapest hilltop house, we would be terribly exposed, but we weren't sure where to go. But before we did that, my parents were feverishly trying to find a telephone operator somewhere in Europe who they could dictate the story of the return of Soviets in full force. And I remember my sister and I bundled up in our overcoats, waiting to be given our marching orders, while my parents seemed oblivious to our presence as they madly dialed, and my father finally found an operator awake somewhere who wept into the phone and said, "It's too late, it's too late." And so then we managed to cross into Pest from Buda before, but we could see in the rearview mirror of our Volkswagen the tanks behind us, and as we rolled off the bridge. And we went to this big hotel in Pest where all the foreign correspondents, you can imagine that the world press were there in full force. They all gathered there and they all started making plans to evacuate. And there we were, the four of us, with really no place to go. But then something amazing happened. My parents' colleagues, American journalists, made such a fuss with the American ambassador to take us in. The American embassy wasn't supposed to give sanctuary to non-Americans. But the journalists raised such hell and saying, look at these two, the Martins have just come out of prison. They went to prison because of America. You can't turn them away now. So ultimately, the ambassador and I, through the State Department files, I have the transcript of the ambassador's conversation with Secretary of State Dulles. The ambassador was told, make your own judgment. And the ambassador, in a judgment call, allowed us in. And that was the beginning, really, of our American journey. We were in from the cold.
Let's go to Marcella, who is back on the phone from Greensboro, North Carolina. Marcella, thank you so much for waiting.
That was Marcella.
Sorry, Marcella.
That's okay. That's fine. Thank you again for taking my call. This is just the very last statement you just made about escaping. I'm actually from the Czech Republic. We used to be Czechoslovakia when we left. And it was the same thing. I remember the tanks coming in, and my mother actually stayed behind. So I have all those memories of growing up with just my father and my family, who was left behind, was interrogated from time to time, they wanted lists of people that had escaped. And so my dad took on a different last name so he could communicate with his parents to let them know that we actually made it into the United States. But, you know, coming here, my dad is a chef. And he was also on the board of directors of a school. When we came, of course, you know, not knowing the language, he had to take any job available. So just the trauma of all of that,
yes.
Coming here. Yeah, and I think a lot of people in this country, even now when I talk to a lot of people, they don't really understand
how
the Eastern and Central Europeans, the things they've had to endure, and how much diversity it is, or the diversity of the various people that have come, and how gifted they are, and how much they've enriched. Exactly.
Yes,
because,
even,
like my brother, for example, he is a research chemist. You know, I'm in international business, and I have a daughter who's in a elite institution.
Well, I will resist boasting about my children, but needless to say, they're brilliant and have contributed immeasurably to American life. But I think it's, you know, we can take some justifiable pride in many immigrant waves have followed us. But I'm sure you'll agree with me, Marcella, when I say that God forbid that there should be need for another wave of refugees from Europe to America or from any other place. I mean, it's just unacceptable that people should live such lives, and for too long it was accepted in that, you know, divided bipolar world that, well, half the world was going to be a captive of the Soviet boot, and we got lucky, Marcella, because you and I grew up here. And but my parents suffered way beyond what they should have, and I must say that one of the shocks really for me in going through these files was to discover that even when we landed here in Washington, D.C., they were being followed by J. Edgar Hoover's agents. That I got from the FBI files, that my parents were suspected of being somehow that they made some kind of a deal to get out of prison, to get out of Hungary. And so for years, they were followed by FBI agents.
Because there was so much suspicion of people who were coming out of Eastern Europe.
The paranoia of the Cold War had its mirror image here.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wmu.org. I want to read you an email that's come in from Rick in Geneva, New York. How difficult was it to obtain the files about your family? What was the process like? Mm-hmm. Did you get any pushback?
Here's how it began. My father spent the last year of his life living with my husband and me. And during that year, he was awarded Hungary's highest civilian award. I will immodestly confess that I have since gotten the same award, but anyway. And with that award, the foreign minister brought a file. And it was one of, as it turned out, thousands of files on my family. But the foreign minister wanted my father to see that this is a new Hungary, an open place that has no secrets. That file lay unopened on my father's desk until he died. When he died 4 years ago, I opened that file and I started reading and stayed up crying one night. Because I wasn't aware of the full horror that my parents had been subjected to. And that's when I decided that I would go back to Budapest and fill out all the paperwork. Under post-communist law, I'm entitled to my family file. It's tedious. You have to go to the archives. You have to fill out the forms. And then you just wait. And I will never forget when I got the call from the head archivist that they had found the files and that I should bring two empty suitcases. And then I sat in the with the head archivist in her office as clerks in white coats wheeled in like shopping carts full of files. And she said to me, "Yes, it's one of our biggest files." And she looked at me like I should be proud. In fact, I was terrified. First of all, I had to go through the whole thing, translate it. I'm able to read Hungarian, so I could translate it myself. But I was terrified as to what they would contain. But when I found the key piece of paper, which said that André Martin, after days of intense interrogation, has not betrayed a single Hungarian, that was my eureka moment. I that gave me the courage to proceed, knowing that nothing really terrible was in there.
But your parents came to America, and even then,
yes,
the Hungarian secret police didn't leave them alone.
No. And in fact, I had one of my more dramatic confrontations with a man who was charged with recruiting my parents from here, from Washington, into the service of the state. Now, why these people thought that, you know, they couldn't bend my parents to their will in their own country, why in Washington, once we had safely settled, that they could, you really have to scratch your head. And I think the answer is that they were delusional and paranoid and not particularly bright.
One of the things that strikes me from the book, of course, is the amount of information. And we hear that as well about Eastern Germany, about the whole, and we're remembering today, of course, the fall of the Berlin Wall, but that it was really swamped by so much information. You filtered through it for the book, Cathy Martin. It is an absolutely gripping tale of life behind the Iron Curtain. Thank you so much for writing it. I'm sure your parents would have been very proud of it.
Thank you, Cathy.
The book is Enemies of the People, My Family's Journey to America. Cathy Martin is the author. Thank you so much for joining me here in the studio.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. Thank you so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.